Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. This summer marks the 75th anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended World War II. The decision by President Harry S. Truman to use the atomic bomb ushered the United States and the world into the nuclear age. This hour, we'll talk with Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace about his new book, Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb and the 116 Days That Changed the World. We begin, though, with the upcoming nuclear talks between the U.S. and Russia, scheduled to take place in Vienna next week. Tops on the agenda is the New START Accord, the last major treaty limiting U.S. and Russian nuclear power, and a treaty that the Trump administration is threatening to scrap unless it can bring China on board as well. Will the U.S. pull out of another nuclear deal? And what about North Korea's recent decision to abandon diplomatic efforts with the United States and work on increasing its own nuclear capabilities? What could all of this mean for the U.S. and for our allies? Well, joining us to shed some light on that and more is Joseph Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation. He has worked on nuclear weapons policy in Washington for over 35 years and is considered one of the top experts in the field. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a former member of the International Security Advisory Board for Secretaries of State John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. Joe Cirincione is the author of the book Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, among others. And he also teaches at the Georgetown University Graduate School of Foreign Service. Joe Cirincione, welcome to Radio Times.
Why, thank you very much, Tracy. It's nice to be back with you.
Well, can you start by telling us what exactly this New START Accord is that is on the agenda for next week in Vienna?
Ever since Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger negotiated the Strategic Arms Limitation Talk Treaty back in 1972, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, now Russia, have had agreements to restrain, limit their nuclear arms, allow for on-site inspections. Those began in the 80s, and then starting with Ronald Reagan to steadily reduce their stockpiles. So these talks, these treaties have been remarkably successful. Each one has made us safer. Each one has reduced the stockpiles, reduced the nuclear risk. We've climbed down from the height of the Cold War when we had about 66,000 nuclear weapons in the world, down to the current state where we have about 13,500. Most of those weapons have always been held by the U.S. and Russia. So when you talk about nuclear weapons in the world, you're basically talking about the United States and Russia with the largest stockpiles. The last remaining treaty is this one. It's called the New START Treaty. It's the continuation of Ronald Reagan's process. And it was negotiated back in 2010 by then President Barack Obama and then President of Russia, Prime Minister of Russia, Medvedev. And this brought the stockpiles in each country down to a limit of 1,500. So strategically deployed nuclear weapons. So neither country could have more than that amount strategically deployed. It was always intended to be another step and to be succeeded by another arms control treaty that would bring it lower and lower and continue the process. But that process stopped after this treaty. And now under President Trump, we have reduced the incentives for countries to engage in these talks. We have stopped negotiations. And the president is questioning whether this treaty itself should continue. It has a time limit on it. It's got an expiration date, and that expiration date is February of next year. It can easily be extended. All it requires is for the head of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and the head of the United States, Donald Trump, to agree to extend the treaty. They just have to sign a letter to each other, and the treaty can be extended for another 5 years, continuing the inspections, continuing the verification. But President Trump has indicated that he's not interested in that extension, so the fate of the entire architecture, the entire arms control regime is now hanging in the balance.
So, Joe, it brings to mind that expression, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It sounds like this agreement has been successful. Why does the Trump administration now want to renegotiate it, perhaps scrap it? Why is it up for grabs at this point?
Yeah, well, ever since the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which you're going to talk with Chris Wallace about, there's been a debate. There's been two points of view. And many people have said we have to get rid of these weapons. These are horrible weapons. They indiscriminately kill thousands, hundreds of thousands of innocent men, women, and children. And other people have said, no, we have to get these weapons. We need more of these weapons. These weapons are essential to our national security. And those two schools of thought have contended for 75 years, sometimes one in the lead, sometimes in the other. In the first two decades of the nuclear age, there were no arms control treaties. And the nuclear weapons spread like a virus. We went from two weapons in 1945. 20 years later, there were 34,000 in the world. And not just one country, but five countries had them. And that's when arms control began in earnest with John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon. And those, what we might call suppression and mitigation techniques, have flattened the curve. They contain this virus, and then they turned it down. And so you can see during those other decades, the last 50 decades, we've been successful in containing this the most dangerous threat to human civilization on the planet, nuclear weapons, which can destroy human civilization in an afternoon. But that other school of thought has always been there, and that's the school of thought that seems to prevail in the Trump administration. We don't want restraints. We want flexibility. We want to be able to build our stockpiles back up. We don't want limitations. U.S. national security is best served by having the strongest military in the world, and we can dominate our opponents if they want to have an arms race with us. We will win the arms race. And that's the school of thought that you now see, not so much in President Trump, who seems rather disinterested in all of this, but certainly in Marshall Billingsley. He's the arms control negotiator for President Trump now, certainly in Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and certainly in John Bolton, the former National Security Advisors. They've been steadily dismantling these nuclear safety guardrails ever since Trump took office. If New START dies, this will be the fourth major arms control agreement that this team has destroyed in their term in office.
So what happens then, Joe, if it does expire in February and there is no new deal in place or the United States walks away from this?
Oh, it's completely predictable. You will see increases in arsenals. I don't think we're going to go back to the tens of thousands of weapons we had during the Cold War. Looking back, you realize we really went nuclear nuts in those days. But you will see a steady increase. You already see it. There's nine nuclear countries in the world, nine countries that have nuclear weapons. Most have a few hundred nuclear weapons, like China. China has about 250. But you can see them developing new weapons. Every single one of these nine nuclear states is building new weapons. Some are developing new types of weapons, like Russia and the United States. The United States is building what we call new, more usable nuclear weapons, smaller nuclear weapons, more Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons. Our weapons are typically 10 to 30 times the size of Hiroshima. And so you can see that this arms race will take off again. And in fact, I believe we're already in a new arms race. There are no reductions anymore. There's no talk of reductions. And with all these countries trying new weapons, new types of weapons, new use doctrines for those weapons, you'll see that spread. And with that spread, you'll see other countries start to reconsider their decision not to have nuclear weapons. These two things have always gone hand in hand: reducing the existing nuclear stockpiles and stopping the spread of these weapons to other countries, what we call non-proliferation, have always been two sides of the same coin. And you can't do one without the other. You have to disarm, you have to reduce in order to convince other countries not to get them. You have to stop other countries from getting them in order to give countries the confidence that they can reduce. If you take those restraints off, we're off to the races. Mm.
Two things I want to ask you, and I want to go back to something you said a moment ago so we can allow it to sink in. I think you said that what we have now in terms of nuclear power is 10 to 30 times the power of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. Did I hear that right?
Yes, you did.
So that is staggering.
It is. When you talk to Chris Wallace in the next half hour, you'll see the horror that Truman had about these weapons and his decision to stop the bombing after just two. The military was already planning a third attack, and he said, no, I don't want to kill any more kids. That's enough. Yeah. Well, this was the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. They were the equivalent of about 15,000 tons of conventional explosive. So one plane with one bomb could destroy a city that normally would take hundreds of planes and thousands of bombs to destroy. That's the power of a nuclear weapon. But those were atomic bombs, the basic fission device. In the 50s, we invented the H-bomb, the hydrogen bomb, a fusion bomb, which fuses atoms together, and each one of those was many times more powerful. So instead of 15,000 tons, 15 kilotons, our average weapon is about 150, 300, 450 kilotons. So anywhere between 10 and 30 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. So when you think of that, just 100 of these weapons are the equivalent of 2,000 to 3,000 Hiroshimas, an enormous destructive force. And the treaty that we're talking about, New START, allows each country to have 1,500 of these weapons, not 100, 1,500. So an enormous destructive force. We still have enormous nuclear overkill, and they're deployed in weapons of all kinds across the board, with only the brain of Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin preventing them from being used. Each one of those leaders has their finger on the nuclear button, and they can press that button anytime they want for whatever reason they want. That's why arms control is so important. That's why reducing the number of weapons, changing the doctrines to make it less likely that they'll be used is considered so important, even as we confront these other multiple crises the country is currently in.
We have just about a minute before we have to take a break, Joe, but it's been reported that the Trump administration wants China to get involved in a new deal with the United States and Russia. Why China? Why is that important?
Well, the Trump administration and many national security experts see China as the rising power, and they're right. And so they, even though China has only 250 or so nuclear weapons, they want to bring China into these talks. And that's not a bad point. They should be in these talks. But China is not going to join these talks while the U.S. and Russia have 20 times, 30 times the arsenal that China has. It's silly, nor is there a point. Remember, the START agreement is a limit. You say you can't have any more than 1,500 nuclear weapons. Well, China would have to build up for years to get to that point. So it doesn't really make any sense. That's why many of us suspect this is a ploy, a con. It's an excuse for getting out of the treaty under the thin justification that it doesn't include China, so therefore it's not a perfect treaty, so therefore we have to get out.
So it's kind of the poison pill, if you will. Joe, I'm going to ask you to stand by for just a moment because we have to take a quick break here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM, and we are talking about nuclear warfare then and now. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We have been talking about the upcoming nuclear talks between the United States and Russia. Those talks begin next week in Vienna, and the Trump administration is saying that it wants to renegotiate the New START Treaty. That is one that was negotiated back around 2010 to renegotiate that with Russia, but wants China included in the deal and is threatening to possibly walk away from the whole deal. We have been talking with Joe Cirincione. He is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation. He's also the host of the Press the Button podcast and the author of numerous books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. Joe, we've been talking about these upcoming talks next week and how the New START Accord that is tops on the agenda expires in February. I am not a nuclear expert, but I'm wondering, is it even realistic that a deal that complex can be renegotiated between now and February, especially if we're, in theory, adding another nation into the mix?
if you believe that it is impossible to negotiate a new treaty that complex between now and then, you're right. You don't have to be an expert. You can look at it and say, and look at the history of how long it takes to negotiate things like this, including complicated inspection and verifications mechanisms and definitions and that, and you can't do it. There's no way. And even if you had a fully functioning State Department, which we do not, you know, for example, we do not now have an Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and National Security. There hasn't been one since Donald Trump fired the last one last year. So we don't have a fully functioning State Department, so it's almost impossible to think about negotiating it. What you can do is simply extend the one you've got. It works. It has the support of the military. It has the support of the almost the entire national security community in the United States. It gives the military the kind of predictability and certainty that they need to make their own force planning documents and forecasts. And so you can extend that for 5 years, and then during that period, go ahead. Go start negotiating the next one, whether it's between the U.S. and Russia, or whether you can come up with some mechanism that would include China. But, you know, don't burn the bridge you're standing on because you think there's a new loftier goal, a more idealistic goal that you'd like to achieve.
I want to ask you about North Korea as well, because in the midst of all of this, North Korea is now saying that it's essentially abandoning diplomacy with the United States. North Korea says it just hasn't worked, and now they're vowing to increase their own nuclear capabilities. How does that play into all of this?
Well, what happens when you look at these things is very often what we're most afraid of is not our own nuclear weapons, despite the power we just discussed, but other people getting them or bad guys getting them. So whenever you hear about North Korea getting nuclear weapons, you're afraid that they might use them. We believe North Korea has enough material for somewhere around 20 or 30 nuclear weapons. And just in 2017, they did 3 tests of long-range missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, that could reach the United States and can probably carry one of those bombs into an American city. So you are justifiably worried about that. There was some hope that the dialogue that Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump had begun with their meeting in Singapore several years ago could lead to a breakthrough, a peace treaty between the U.S. and North Korea, finally ending the Korean War, which, as you know, only ended with an armistice, not an actual treaty, and could lead to the steady reduction of the North Korean nuclear threat, maybe even its elimination. But that has failed. We have nothing to show for that. The North Koreans have increased their nuclear arsenal in this time, and now you see that Kim Jong-un is apparently fed up, and he has issued blistering talks condemning the United States, condemning South Korea, and just yesterday blew up in a very dramatic gesture. Nobody was injured. People were evacuated, but blew up the liaison office that had been opened up in the last 2 years so that North Korean and South Korean officials could meet. So I think you're looking at not just the failure of the Trump initiative towards North Korea, but now its very dangerous consequences, which is North Korea might engage again full speed ahead on new missiles, new weapons, new tests.
Speaking of blowing things up, Joe, I was reading something that you wrote recently that the Trump administration has been reportedly discussing possibly restarting nuclear weapons tests for the first time since 1992. Is that accurate? And what do you say about that?
Yes, it is accurate. And Marshall Billingsley, again, the arms control negotiator for Donald Trump, raised this in a recent talk. And it appears to be two purposes. One is that it appears to be a negotiating ploy. The view is that you can bluster and threaten your adversaries, Russia and China, with new nuclear tests, and this will convince them to go to the bargaining table. Highly unlikely that that's going to work. And the other is just that there are some people who do want to test. We haven't tested nuclear weapons in almost 30 years. We don't need to. We have advanced computer simulations. We spend billions of dollars every year on what's called the Stockpile Stewardship Program to make sure that our nuclear weapons are reliable and effective, and our national labs certify every year that everything's fine, thank you. We don't need to do new tests. But some have always wanted to test. Really, the old line nuclear laboratory directors for whom testing was the epitome of their craft. And if you don't test, then you're not really doing nuclear weapons science. And the Senate Armed Services Committee just in recent days put in $10 million to prepare for new nuclear tests. This would be a huge mistake, which is why so many of us are alarmed about it and why we hope the House will firmly resist this. If we do a nuclear test, you are firing a starting gun to other nations to start their tests again. If we do a nuclear test, you're basically saying, gentlemen, start your engines. If we test, India and Pakistan will almost certainly test, probably China, almost certainly North Korea. So a U.S. nuclear test would be the beginning of a new nuclear test race with unforeseen consequences. That's why it's such a bad idea to put that kind of money in a Senate bill and why we have to stop this initiative before it's too late.
Joe, we have just another moment or so before I have to say goodbye to you. We've got Chris Wallace standing by from Fox News Sunday to talk about his new book about the atomic bomb. But before I let you go, I have to ask you, what is your sense as to where all of this is going to end up, where the talks that are scheduled to begin next week are going to end up with the new START Accord?
The talks next week in Vienna will almost certainly fail, and Russia has indicated they have that China has no interest in joining these talks, and if that is the condition for the U.S. continuing these talks, it will fail. So I believe this initiative will fail. I think it might be designed to fail. It's easy to succeed in negotiations if your objective is failure. It's an old ploy. Demand the impossible but make it seem reasonable. State it as a matter of principle. So when it fails, you can claim that you're standing on firm principle and the other side is being unreasonable. I think that's the gambit that you're seeing here. It's one they used as a justification for pulling out of the Open Skies Treaty, which allowed overflights of other countries. It's what they did to justify pulling out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that Ronald Reagan negotiated that limited weapons of a certain range in Europe and worldwide. It's what they did in justifying pulling out of the Iran deal. I believe that what you're seeing here is an elaborate kabuki dance designed to let the last remaining arms control treaty die. So I have no expectations that these talks will succeed. Mm.
Joe Cirincione, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me on, Tracy. Bye-bye.
And Joe is, as we mentioned, the president of the Plowshares Fund. He is widely recognized as one of the top experts in the world as it relates to nuclear weapons. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. And in keeping with our theme of nuclear arms, this summer marks the 75th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the United States. The bombings brought about Japan's surrender and an end to World War II, but sparked an ethical debate that continues until this day. The making of the atomic bomb, codenamed the Manhattan Project, was conducted in utter secrecy at locations all around the country. Scientists, military leaders, even teenage civilians were all part of the effort, whether they knew it at the time or not. It is a fascinating story, and it's chronicled in a new book by Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace, Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb and the 116 Days That Changed the World, takes us from Washington, D.C. to Los Alamos, New Mexico, to the island of Tinian off the coast of Japan where the bombing raid was launched. Chris Wallace, of course, is a veteran journalist who has covered almost every major political event, interviewed seven U.S. presidents and other world leaders, and won accolades as the first Fox News anchor to moderate a general election presidential debate in 2016. He has won every major broadcast news award for his reporting, and he also happens to be the son of the late legendary Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes. Chris Wallace, welcome to Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Tracy. That was a mouthful, that introduction.
Well, and you've done quite a lot, so.
Well, in 50 years, I hope so.
Well, we're delighted to have you with us to talk about your new book. And of all of the seminal moments in U.S. history that you could have chosen to write about, why this one? Why the atomic bomb?
Well, it's a little bit complicated, but I had wanted to take a key moment in American history for some period of time and tell it almost like a thriller, almost in the present tense, where you would, because sometimes I think history is written so much from after the fact. Obviously, it's all written from after the fact, but it reads that way. So it's, we know what happened, here's why it happened, and that's not what I wanted. I wanted to take you along for the ride as it's happening, as Truman is meeting with his war cabinet to decide what to do, as you mentioned, the scientists at Los Alamos are working on what they call the gadget, the first atom bomb, and don't know whether or not it's going to work or not. And then the pilots on Tinian Island, the flight crew, who, as they take the bomb to Hiroshima, because it's never been dropped out of a plane before, don't know whether, one, it will be a dud, or two, it'll be massively explosive and may knock them out of the sky. So the best review I got is somebody said, we know what happened in 1945, but this reads like a thriller, which is just what I wanted to do. Now, why this particular event? It goes back to February of 2019. It was the day that Donald Trump was going to deliver the State of the Union speech. And that afternoon, and this is a common thing, that if the president and the Speaker of the House are from opposing parties, that the Speaker gives a pre-buttal. It's a rebuttal, but before the fact. And Nancy Pelosi, who was the Speaker in 2019, called several anchors in and was telling us all the reasons why the president's speech, which he hadn't delivered yet, was going to be terrible. But the most interesting part of the conversation is that it happened in something called the Board of Education. I was very excited about it because that was the room that Sam Rayburn, Mr. Sam, when he was the Speaker of the House in the 1940s, that was his hideaway. And he would have people come in there and gossip about politics, get marching orders on strategy, have a bourbon and branch water. And she said it was in this room that Truman called the White House because they were looking for him. And they said, get to the White House as quickly and quietly as possible. And Truman hung up the phone, Nancy Pelosi telling the story. And he said, Jesus Christ and General Jackson. And I suddenly thought to myself, that's my moment. And I didn't know then, but it was 116 days from when Truman becomes, as he has been called, the accidental president until the bomb is dropped on Hiroshima.
And of course, Truman himself didn't know about the Manhattan Project when he became president.
Well, that's the amazing thing. And the wonder of writing history is you find out all these remarkable facts that you didn't know. And one of them, you're exactly right, Tracy, is he goes to the White House. He thinks he's going to meet Roosevelt there. And instead, when he gets there, Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady, tells him Harry, the president, is dead. So now, instead of speaking to the president, he is the president. He's sworn in. He talks to his cabinet. They all leave. Henry Stimson, the 77-year-old Secretary of War, says, Mr. President, I need to speak to you in private. They go into another room, and he says, I need to tell you about an immense top-secret project to build the most powerful weapon in history. And that's basically all he tells him. He says, I'm going to give you some time to settle in, and then I'll come back and brief you in detail. And Truman, you know, he's suddenly the president. He's now in charge of the commander-in-chief of prosecuting the wars in Europe and the Pacific. He's got everything else on his mind. This is just one more item. He doesn't make that much of it, but that, you're right, is literally the first he gets any inkling of the existence of the Manhattan Project to develop the atom bomb.
And then, of course, he's the one who is faced with making that decision. Can you talk a little bit, Chris, about his decision-making process that summer when he was in the talks at Potsdam in Germany, talking about or thinking through the information that he's getting from the United States on the progress of this bomb and how he made his decision?
Well, there are three things that really impressed me, Tracy, about his decision-making process. I certainly knew about Truman, but I can't say I was any student of Truman. And so I kind of knew what I think most of your listeners know, famously decisive, the buck stops here, he makes a decision, he never second guesses himself. It was a lot more complicated than that, because first of all, the choice wasn't drop the bomb or nothing. It was drop the bomb or invade Japan. So he has a series of meetings during the spring and into the summer of 45, and most of them are about invading. And what he is told by the top general, the top people at the Pentagon, is if you invade, that we're now in the summer of 45, the war will go on until at least November of 46, and we project there will be 1 million Japanese casualties and 500,000 American casualties. He doesn't take the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project that seriously, because they've never tested it, so they have no idea whether it's going to work. He thought it was a science project. He gets to Potsdam for a summit with Churchill and Stalin, and he's now filling the very big shoes of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and a little bit insecure about that. You know, with the big three, he's not sure he's up to being part of the big three. And on the day, his first full day in Potsdam, July 16th, they test the bomb at Alamogordo, New Mexico, and it works. And he finds out about it about 8 o'clock that night, and suddenly he knows that he may be the junior partner in the big three, but in fact, he's got the most leverage. He's got the most powerful weapon ever developed. So first of all, the meticulousness of his decision-making process, that he goes over it again and again, and you know, the pluses and minuses of the bomb, pluses and minuses of invasion. The second thing is he wasn't afraid or resentful of dissent. He welcomed it. And in fact, a few days before the bomb is dropped, he has lunch with Dwight Eisenhower and Omar Bradley, two of the great figures of the war in Europe. And Eisenhower says, I don't think you should drop the bomb. I think Japan is going to surrender anyway. And I also don't think we should be the first country to unleash this technology on the world. Truman didn't follow that advice, but he welcomed it. He wanted to hear everybody's point of view. And the third thing I would say,
Chris, before you get to that, I'm gonna stop you right there. I have to take a quick break, but hold that thought. We'll be back with Chris Wallace and more on his new book in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Tracy Matisak filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Chris Wallace, the host of Fox News Sunday. He, along with Mitch Weiss, is the author of a new book, Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb and the 116 Days That Changed the World. We only have Chris with us for a short time today, but if you'd like to shoot us an email or a tweet, perhaps you've got a question for him about the book or about his work, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Chris, when we left off, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you, but you were talking about President Truman's decision-making process about dropping the atomic bomb, and we got two out of the 3 points in before we had to take a break.
I know, I've been sitting here thinking, what's that third thing? Now, just quickly, I would say, Tracy, that he, for all the talk about how famously decisive he was, he agonized over this decision. He was in Potsdam, a suburb of Berlin, as I say, for a big three summit with Churchill and Stalin. He couldn't sleep at night. He complained of fierce headaches. And, you know, one of the joys, we cover presidents in real time, and you don't know what's going on inside their head. But when you're writing a history, you can look at their diaries and their letters, and you do find out. He wrote about the bomb in very apocalyptic terms in his diary. He calls it this terrible weapon. He describes it as the fire destruction prophesied in the Bible. So he was fully aware of the enormous consequences of dropping the bomb. He went ahead and did it, but it was not an easy decision.
Chris, as you researched all of this for yourself, where do you come down on the decision that President Truman was faced with that summer?
Well, there are sort of two questions. There's the morality question, and I guess I'm going to leave that to other people. And then there's the practical question. And the practical question I would say he really had no choice. Roosevelt had approved the Manhattan Project in 1942. It had been going on for 2+ years. 125,000 people were involved in it, from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, to Los Alamos, to Hanford, Washington. $2 billion had been spent, which in the 1940s was real money. He now is presented after July 16th. He knows he has a weapon that, if it works, can end the war. And he's got on the other side the argument, well, if you invade, the bloodbath will be even worse for Japanese and for Americans. So one of the things I know that was going on in the conversations were, if he didn't use the bomb, if he went ahead with the invasion of Japan, that when people found out 6 months, a year later, whenever they found out you had a bomb or a device that could have perhaps ended the war immediately, and instead you sent hundreds of thousands of Americans to be either killed or very badly wounded, that would have been an impossible choice to make. And, you know, some people say, well, they were about to surrender. The problem with that I have is they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and the Japanese still didn't surrender, which is why they, 3 days later, after they continued to fight on, they dropped a second bomb on Nagasaki, and the military government in Tokyo still wanted to fight on. And it was only that the Emperor Hirohito went over their heads and delivered a radio address, first time almost any Japanese citizen had ever heard the Emperor's voice, a radio address to the nation saying, we have to surrender. So I don't think surrender was in the cards without dropping the bomb.
Well, Chris, I want to ask you about a couple of other things, but I just want to remind our audience that the book is called Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb and the 116 Days That Changed the World. We would be remiss, Chris, if we didn't ask you about some current events, some of the very stories that you are talking about on Fox News Sunday and about your work at Fox News. And, you know, as I was reading your book, you talked about Lafayette Square and how when the news broke that the war was finally over, that the Japanese had surrendered, that people spilled onto Lafayette Square just rejoicing. And I could not help but think about recent events at Lafayette Square, particularly a couple of weeks ago when the president had the area cleared and walked over to the church, and the protests that have taken place on that spot and across the country and indeed the world ever since then in the wake of the death of George Floyd. Would love to hear your thoughts about the protests that are going on around the country and the world and sort of where we are in this moment.
Well, you know, having you said at one point, a veteran newsman, which is a very nice way, Tracy, of saying, excuse me, a little bit old. I've been in the business 50 years. I'm 72 years old, very proud of it. So I've seen a lot. And I remember 68. Excuse me. And the thing, which I think was even worse in terms of the division in the country and the racial riots after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Washington was really on fire. It was not just protests and a little looting of stores. The neighborhoods were on fire. But the point being, we've seen this movie before, and, you know, there's something terrible that happens, and there are protests and sometimes violence and demands for reform, and Washington talks about what to do. And in the end, well, to put it one way, George Floyd is still dead. You know, things don't change enough. And so I know the president today is about to sign an executive order, which will do a limited number of things. And then he's going to pushing with Republicans in Congress to pass a bill. And that'll be different than the Democratic bill that they have come up with. I guess I'd have to say, and I hope to death I'm wrong, but I guess I have to say I'm not terribly optimistic that all of this will end up in fundamental change that people will feel in the street. I did an interview with Ben Carson, the former world-famous brain surgeon and now the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development on Fox News Sunday this week. And I was talking with him about race in America, and a lot of people in the administration sort of, well, there are bad actors, but there's not a systemic problem. And I said, tell me honestly, did you ever have the talk with your kids? And you know, the talk, obviously, that black parents have with their children about how to behave and how to be on your guard so that you don't get in trouble with the police, not because you broke the law, but because you're black. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, of course I did, just as my father did with me and I did with my three sons. And I found that terribly sad, not that he had done it, but I think if you ask the vast majority of your white listeners, they would say they didn't have the talk, that their parents never said to them, you got to be careful if you're around a policeman, where they had it with their children. Because I think we don't feel that same sense of threat from police that the routine average African-American does. And that's terribly sad. And I just don't know, when you get to that fundamental level, whether that's going to change.
Yeah. Well, and I so relate to what you're saying, Chris. As an African-American mom of three, I have absolutely had the talk, and we have reminder talks every now and then as well. I want to ask you about the spikes that we're seeing as well with COVID-19 of late, particularly in the South and the West. We've seen the numbers going up in places like Texas and Florida of late, and I know that you've been talking about that on Fox News Sunday as well. Your thoughts on where we are in the pandemic?
Well, first of all, we don't really know. I had one of the top epidemiologists in the country on the show this last week, Dr. Michael Osterholm, who's at the University of Minnesota. And, you know, he said, we've got to be humble. We really don't know. But to give you a sense of how little progress we've made on this, there's a general feeling among epidemiologists that 60% of the country needs to get a disease for there to be a herd mentality. Now you're only dealing with about 40% that doesn't have some measure of immunity. We now have 5% of the country that has had COVID, not died, 5% that's even had the disease. So we're nowhere near herd immunity. And, you know, when you were talking about the protests, one thing I didn't like about the protests, I certainly, as a child of the 60s, believe in protest. I was concerned and am still concerned about what's going to happen in a week or two when the incubation period runs out and see whether there was a spike in the virus because of this. You know, the interesting thing is that the parts of the country that were the toughest and took a lot of criticism for locking down are the ones that are dealing with it the best, and where you see the number of cases dropping most precipitously, like New York, like New Jersey, places in the Northeast, and a lot of the places that were the slowest to close and the earliest to open up are having real problems, like Arizona and Texas and Florida. And, you know, one of the things, ideal being the host of a Sunday talk show in spin all the time, you know, people's talking points. But one of the things I said as soon as this COVID got serious in mid-March was, I am not interested in spin. I'm only interested in facts and data and science. So the only people I've had on the show are either the health professionals from the administration, like Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx, or independent people who, you know, don't have an axe to grind, pro or con. There's a terrific epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins, Tom Inglesby, and Michael Osterholm at the University of Minnesota. You can't spin a disease any more than you can spin a hurricane. It's going to happen. It's going to take its course. It's a physical phenomenon. And talking points don't do you any good.
Yeah. And it's a story that's not going away anytime soon.
Unfortunately, it appears not. And the latest, you know, these models I don't take too seriously because they keep changing. But now they're talking about 200,000 dead from a model at the University of Washington by October. So, no, it's not going to go away. And places that are opening too quickly, or, you know, where people just, I don't understand when people say, well, I'm just tired of social distancing, mm-hmm. so I'm going to take off my mask, or I'm not going to observe the 6 feet of distancing. You can't fool Mother Nature. It is what it is, and you have to deal with it.
Yeah. You are listening to WHYY-FM. This is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscoen. Chris, I also want to ask you about your work at Fox News, and I want to read to you something from a recent article about you in The Guardian, and it said the following. Fox News is seen by critics as a centrifugal force in the decay of consensus, the coarsening of political debate, and the polarization of the country. It is also said to be the propaganda arm of Trump's White House, or, in the words of one academic interviewed by The New Yorker last year, the closest we've come to having state TV. But, significantly, not Wallace's show. And it goes on to talk about your show as an oasis of critical thinking, insightful questions that draw blood from administration allies and opponents alike. How do you respond, Chris, to the criticism of Fox News as an extension of the Trump administration? What is it like for you working in that environment?
I'll answer the last part first. It's the best job I've ever had since I was hired by Roger Ailes in 2003 and have been the host of Fox News Sunday ever since. I have never been second-guessed on a question that I've asked or a guest that I have interviewed. As you say, there was a famous football coach named Vince Lombardi, and somebody asked one of his players, does he discriminate? And treat the stars differently than the grunts. And he said, no, he treats us all like dogs. And that, I hope, is my mantra for politicians, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative. I view myself as the cop on the beat with swinging the nightstick and trying to keep them all honest. I think that there's a division, which I think most viewers understand and most media critics I think purposely misunderstand, which is that there's a difference between opinion and news. And we have on the news side thousands of people who travel the world, cover wars, or put themselves on the front line of viruses or hurricanes or whatever, whether it's reporters or camera crews or editors or producers, to tell the news and to tell it honestly. Our prime time is opinion and is definitely conservative and these days is tilted towards Trump. I would argue that it's no more tilted to the right than primetime at CNN or MSNBC is tilted to the left. But the vast majority of daytime, I'd say from 9 a.m. until 8 o'clock at night, is straight news reporting. And Lord knows, and I'll speak primarily for myself, I defy anybody, and particularly if you read the president's tweets about me, I don't think he thinks I'm an arm of Trump TV.
Well, speaking of the president's tweets, he has called you nasty and obnoxious, has called your interviews dumb and unfair, and also said he likes your dad better than you. What do you say?
Well, I'll tell you what my son said when the nasty, obnoxious one came out. As only a son can say to a father, he emailed me and he said, nasty, or I'm trying to think what he said. He said, obnoxious, yes. Nasty, maybe not. So, I don't know. If you're a political reporter, if you don't get criticized by both sides, look, I've run afoul of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Donald Trump. So I'm batting 1,000 in terms of ticking off presidents, both of the right and the left. Hmm.
So, Chris, we've got about 30 seconds in our last few moments here. Lesson learned from 2016. What might you do differently journalistically, not just you, but Fox News, or just as you're covering the upcoming election? What'd you learn from 2016 that might be different in 2020?
Well, I don't know that it'll be different or not, but I think that we have to be very careful, and I would say this of all journalists, of all political stripes, that you have to be very careful to be sensitive to what's going on outside of the coast, outside of the elite, outside of the conventional wisdom. The big surprise that we didn't pay enough attention to in 2016 is that a lot of the middle America and working class and rural Americans really felt a call to Donald Trump, and I don't think that was reflected, and it certainly wasn't reflected in the exit polls. And I don't know, maybe this time they'll have turned on him and they'll go to Biden, but we need to be sampling the opinions of all Americans and what they feel about the state of the country, not just the elite.
Chris Wallace, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Tracy.
The book is called Countdown 1945. The author is Chris Wallace, along with Mitch Weiss. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. Our engineer is Adam Leshefsky. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen.